This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 13th of October 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to episode 223 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Tom Edwards.
On today's show, the sky's the limit as we welcome soundtrack composer Simon Fisher-Turner to the show to discuss how to score a film about Mount Everest shot all the way back in 1924.
We'll be hearing from zoologist and surrealist painter Desmond Morris, the author of famed book The Naked Ape, is back with a cultural follow-up, The Artistic Ape. We'll be getting the big picture later.
And we'll be learning about the ideas of Victorian-era Britain from writer and journalist Simon Heffer.
That's all to come. Plus, with Tom on this side of the microphone, Daniel Giacopelli will be here with next week's news. There'll also be some music right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. So, Tom, hello.
Steve, hello. It's exciting for me to escape from the shackles of my news look-ahead.
The news shackles.
To be let loose on the Monocle Weekly. I'm pretty excited to be here.
I know, I'm slightly worried, but, you know, there was no one else.
Oh, you do know how to emasculate someone. Now, tell me, Steve, it's been a busy week, as ever, really, at Midori House.
It has.
You've not been in Midori House all week. You were up in Stockholm at the start, when the week commenced, am I right?
I was.
What
I
were
was
you doing up there?
I was meeting with our correspondent, Elna Naikkanen Anderson. And her lovely husband, Eric, went to see their flat.
Lovely.
Very, very nice flat.
Did they lay on a nice spread for you? Any sort of...
They did, actually.
Canapés, that kind of thing?
Salmon.
Oh.
Salmon and potatoes. It was all very good.
Nice.
Very Swedish. And they've got, as you'd imagine, you know, because Elna is, you know, our correspondent and her husband, Eric, is an architect, rather a nice little flat they've got there.
Did you sort of imagine a Steve Bloomfield life?
What if I was
in Stockholm?
If I was to replace Elna as our Stockholm correspondent.
Very possibly.
I don't know how happy she'd be about that. I don't know how happy Eric would be as well if I was to replace
Elna.
Well,
I wasn't suggesting he would move into their flat.
Oh, right. Oh, okay.
And you'd have to just boot them out. But a nice city. You've been before, I think. Do you enjoy visiting Stockholm?
I've had a bit of a Swedish thing recently. Also, I was interviewing the Prime Minister, which was quite good fun.
Yeah, well, I should bet.
Yeah, yeah.
Was he an agreeable gent?
He was. Also, everyone calls him Frederick. Not Prime Minister. It's all like, oh, yeah, yeah, Frederick's just coming.
That's nice and friendly.
I think
people should take a leaf out of that particular book.
Yeah, yeah. So that is for our December-January issue, which is coming up. We're going to have a big interview series of various sort of heads of states and CEOs and big cheeses.
That is some
from
big,
all over the world.
Cheeses don't come a lot bigger than that, do they?
No, no. So Stockholm was good, and then I came back here to find that, you know, things seem to be running smoothly without me.
Absolutely. We like to run a tight ship, Steve. Sometimes without, you know... Sometimes you can just confuse the matter, frankly.
Really? Oh, well, I can confuse it.
Yeah, absolutely.
It'll go swimmingly until I show up.
Yeah, you can, you know, you upset a lot of people and...
Look, I don't... It's not that I upset a lot of people. I just, you know...
You're a hard taskmaster. That's good.
Exacting.
Keep people on their toes.
I feel that it's necessary because also some of our... Let's face it. Some of our younger producers, like that American chap.
He needs a leash kept on him.
Yeah, you know, we need to keep a close eye on what it is he does. So close now, in fact, that we've actually asked him to step up to the plate, as I believe the Americans say.
That is what they say.
And let him do next week's news. Now, before he comes in, have you given him your crystal ball?
I can't lend that out to anyone, Steve. You know how these things from, you know, mythology work. If anyone else other than me gazes into the crystal ball, some terrible fate might befall them.
The news ball.
Exactly, the news bauble. So I haven't shared that out. So he's going to have to trust to his own judgment. So okay. We may all be in trouble.
Well, flying blind, here's Daniel Giacopelli. And here he is. Are you just sniffing yourself?
What's your thing?
Daniel Giacopelli there just sniffed himself.
Something smells weird.
There we are. Daniel Giacopelli, everybody.
He's probably been burning a candle at both ends on a Saturday night.
God, I had a really good introduction for you all set up, and you just go and sniff yourself. Anyway,
this can't
Danny,
be my 15 minutes of fame, Steve.
Welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
What have we got? What is next week's news? Bring it to us right now.
Starting today, Steve, the Hajj takes place, the pilgrimage to Mecca. Millions of Muslims will be heading there. It starts today. It goes through Friday. I'm sure you're looking forward to this.
I am, actually. It's a massive event, and also often in the UK, it's broadcast.
Is it really? On what channel?
Channel 4 often does a little sort of Hajj special. They do it in actually quite a good way.
I'm often quite wary about it because it does seem, although it's a wonderful occasion and that kind of movement of people on that scale is always, there's something inherently impressive about it. But it can be quite dangerous, can't it? Because everyone's kind of piling into these holy sites. There can be quite a lot of disorder. People tend to sort of mass and, you know, pour over it. There's quite a sort of seething mass of people. I'm relatively...
Just from a health and safety point of view, you have concerns.
I am red flagging this on a health and safety basis.
I was in Puntland in Somalia at the port. It was around this time of year. And the port was absolute chaos, filled with thousands, and I'm not kidding, thousands of livestock, of goats and indeed camels, all being put on ships to be taken over to Saudi Arabia to feed the masses.
Sorry,
at the Hajj.
The camels for feeding?
Honestly, if you haven't...
Camel meat.
Honestly, it is amazing. Look up images on the internet, I'm sure you'll find them, of a camel being winched onto a ship. It's quite something.
The cottage industry around the Hajj is actually pretty amazing. I think we've covered it on Monocle 24. I mean, the amount of tour operators, the logistical nightmare of transporting all these people. What do they eat? Where do they sleep? What do they buy? I mean, it's fascinating. It's a gigantic kind of opportunity for that region once
and
a year.
Who would have thought that the Hajj was essentially an enormous part of the Somali economy?
It's certainly not me, Steve. Now I'm enlightened. Yeah. That's so often on the Monocle Weekly. There's also other interesting things. I didn't realize even little nuances about people being able to then, you know, colour their hair and these kind of things in the future if they've been on the Hajj. I never realized that before. Very intriguing. You see those gentlemen with their orange hair and orange beards. That's a mark of distinction. They've done the Hajj that year. Did you know that?
I
knew that.
It's interesting though, isn't it?
There we are.
I'm nodding my head.
Very good, Danny.
I think we've used up our Hajj facts. Go on, Danny.
That was interesting. What else have you got?
Starting on Monday, Syria officially joins the Chemical Weapons Convention.
Ah, excellent. Let's pop some champagne corks.
Yeah.
What does this actually mean, though?
No idea. Probably nothing. The inspectors are there right now. They're doing their work.
You know, one of the problems that they have if they sign up to the Chemical Weapons Ban Treaty is that you are not allowed to move chemical weapons out of your country if you've signed this treaty. And yet, under this deal, we're asking them to move chemical weapons out of the country.
Over to Cyprus.
So now Assad could come back and say, well, I can't move it out.
So it's potentially an empty gesture. I guess even as empty gestures go, it's one of the better ones.
Yeah, exactly. It's, you know, this whole thing is a moderate step in almost the right direction. There we are.
That's a kind of
no better slogan.
A semi-endorsement from Steve Bloomfield. They should be pleased with that.
Let's move on to culture. So on Tuesday, I'm sure you're all looking forward to the Man Booker Prize announcement and some pretty big names up for grabs.
Where does the Jacopelli dime go in terms of predicting the winner this year?
Probably The Lowland. Have you read that book, Tom?
I haven't yet.
Rave reviews. Steve might have read.
I haven't read The Lowland, no, but it's an interesting set of authors on the list because yet there are some big names. There's also some people that are less well known, and also one novel in particular, which is 1,000 pages long, but was originally started life as an ebook.
Is there still a place for these? What do you reckon, Steve? You still sort of welcome these sorts of literary prizes? Do they do enough to focus attention on literature to promote some worthy recipients? Or do you think it all becomes
I reckon they're all
mayhem.
Worthwhile. I think most authors that complain about these sorts of things are those that have never been nominated for anything. But yeah, no, they're a good thing. And they sort of, you know, so long as they're judged well, and the Man Booker is pretty good. The only issue I have with the Man Booker is there's some talk about...
Letting the Yankees in.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of that.
Got to be a retrograde step.
You've got the Pulitzer.
We don't want literary imperialism.
Says the British man.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We've had that in the past, and it was fine.
I believe it's the British and Commonwealth authors. What's the Commonwealth, Tom? Where did that come from?
Danny, this is not the time for history. What will for you be a humiliating history lesson?
The Commonwealth, of course, you know, the US was in the Commonwealth a while ago. And I must say, the US seemed to be far better run than it was. It used to have a government and everything that used to, you know, work
until you burn down the seat of government or the home of the leader.
Well, if you're going to be picky over details.
We went on a tour of Congress once, me and Andrew and Rob. And then we got to a certain point, and he goes, and here we are. This is, you know, this is Congress. And look at these pillars here and look at these sort of amazing stuff. And I was like, oh, what's this pillar here? It's quite sort of dirty. You know, does anyone clean it? It says, oh, no, that's the stain from the fire when you tried to burn it down 200 years ago. Oh, okay. Moving on.
Indeed we shall, Steve. I, for one, have had quite enough of Daniel Jacopelli for this Sunday. But Daniel, thanks anyway.
No, he did all right. He did all right.
Well, he's no Tom Edwards.
Well, he doesn't have his own theme tune. That is true. We did think about making some theme music for you, Danny.
Not yet.
Okay, yeah.
I think maybe something by some kind of marching band.
Really? Well, like not? A high school marching band.
Something like that. I could see Danny getting...
I'm surprised you didn't offer the theme song of The Sopranos, Tom.
We could do something like that. Yeah. Okay. Well,
full
next time...
Ideas.
Look, if you step up your game next time... I mean, those were all right. It was a decent mix. I feel like I've got an idea of what's happening in the news next week.
I'll head to Birmingham next week.
Okay, that was just mockery. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. Danny Jacopelli is leaving us now. We'll be back with stuff after this.
Vanuit London... Dit is Monaco 24.
Wei yu Lundun, this is Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda,
London. London, Europe, top.
Hong Kong,
Hong Kong.
Zurich,
London. London.
This is Monaco 24.
Despite being conquered more than half a century ago by climbers Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay, Mount Everest is still the iconic challenge looming above all others. But some believe the tallest peak on Earth was actually reached first, a good 30 years before that, by British mountaineers George Mallory and Andrew Irvine in 1924.
The pair died on the mountain near the peak, their bodies lost in the snow, until the discovery of Mallory's remains 75 years later. And sadly, nobody can be certain whether they had reached the top or not.
But part of their journey was captured in the silent film The Epic of Everest by expedition member Captain John Knoll. The film has recently been restored and is hitting cinemas across the UK this October, accompanied by an intense, brooding new soundtrack of textured noise and sounds from Himalayan region. The soundtrack's composer is Simon Fisher-Turner, a producer, musician, actor and one-time teen pop star, whose work has also adorned the films of masters such as Derek Jarman and David Lynch.
Let's start perhaps by talking about Epic of Everest, because that's, I guess, what you're preoccupied with just at the moment. This is a lot of people will be familiar, won't they, with the tale of sort of Mallory's ill-fated attempt to conquer the peak and that kind of thing. Maybe not so familiar with some of this extraordinary footage that exists of these attempts, you know, period pieces which have been restored. Remind us about that and remind us what exactly you've done to help bring this to wider attention. Now
I've tried it's a silent film. It was shot in 1924. It was first shown in England after these guys fell off the mountain. Everybody came back, the film was assembled, it was shot, and it became a sort of, it toured America. The film was very successful. It's seen by millions of people. The lamas, who were the monks, were imported from Tibet to kind of pray and bang drums and bits and bobs. And so what I was asked to do was to bring this silent film to life, as they say.
Well, how do you start doing that? Because presumably you want to bring your own sort of musical style to it, a contemporary take. But well, I guess you want to reflect some of those local instruments, the local musical
heritage.
Well,
you have to be a bit careful, otherwise you start sort of insulting people. And it can turn into a yoga film, which is ridiculous, or it can turn into a sort of ethnological musical journey somehow. But I mean, I just had to attack it from the way I normally attack it. Is I look at it, I get on the internet, and then I look at it, and I try and read as much as possible. And then I try to find people. And my first port of call was Chris Bonington, Everest climbers. He was very helpful. I went to the Alpine Club, who were very helpful. I met authors, and I kind of just dived into the history of the expedition.
So do you try to make it, in a sense, as much of a collaboration as it can be when... Actually, you're on your own. Yeah, so exactly. Because, you know, normally a soundtrack, you know, on a film, okay, it's some sort of a collaboration.
Well, it's always a collaboration, yeah. But normally it's a collaboration with the director who's alive.
Exactly.
In this case, yes, the director's dead and there's no notes, there's silence, really. And so what you've got to do is fill all the silence. And I really tried to attack this film in the way I did another. I've done silent films before, and really I've sort of gone the archaeological way, where I've got sounds which I thought came from the period or did come from the period, because I've always been sound based. And I realised that I didn't really want to do it that this way, that way, this way, that way. I didn't want to do it this, that way. So I rethought and I went music, forget sound, go musical, because I kept on having great sound ideas, but I was never able to really kind of fulfill the ideas. I thought of, you know, breathing, Chris Bonington climbers. I tried to get tapes of climbing and I tried to research as much as possible. Both these climbers went to university. They were both rowers. So I thought, great, they fall off the mountain. You can go, you know, big noise, then silence, and then you just hear rollocks. You just hear rowing. And then I tried to get tapes of rowing, and I looked, and I couldn't find them. I got hold of the universities. People quite not as helpful as I thought they might have been. I tried to find Tibetan musicians. You think it would be easy? Not quite as easy as you think. Anyway, I did get hold of a Nepalese family eventually and brought them in. Meanwhile, I discovered brass, but not real brass, synthetic brass, samples of brass. And I suddenly went, of course, brass, banging things, horns, long horns, all that, you know, kitchen utensils. It was a big collaboration with myself for rather too long. And then I met this family, the Tapas, and Madan and his daughter Ruby, and they really helped out. He played two or three really important local instruments from Nepal, and she sang. And I just kind of sank into this brassy white space, I suppose.
Fantastic. And viewers...
Well, I don't know if it's fantastic.
Well, I think, but viewers and listeners will be able to judge themselves, won't they, in London on Friday the 18th, is that right?
They will, yes. We're playing it at the part of the London Film Festival. It's a gala. We're playing it live. Live and live.
And this is sort of happening increasingly now, isn't it? That, you know, that films, particularly silent films, will have new soundtracks that will then be performed live. There was... The Pet Shop Boys did one for Battleship Potemkin a few years ago.
Yeah.
Why do you think that's become a thing? Why do you think it's obviously you're quite happy it's become a thing.
It's nice to be part of something like that. I have no idea. I guess
there's something about those events, aren't there?
They are special.
Yeah.
For sure, they're special because you're performing, you're making it up as you go along. I mean, mine isn't a scored thing. I'm not saying you must play this here, you must play that there. I'm collaborating. Here comes the collaboration. I'm collaborating with musicians. You know, we're all going along the same path, but really you can do what you want unless I give you a wicked look and then obviously, you know, halt, please. But, you know, hopefully you collaborate with people. And it's a bit like, I mean, I hate to use the word, but it's a bit like being a jazz musician. But I hate jazz. It's kind of like zzz, so forget the jazz. It's just the zzz at the end of the jazz. We're improvising.
sounds like sleeping, though.
No, I know, but we're improvising it. But it's not, though. It's a special kind of zzz. We're improvising, but we're not, you know, we're musicians. It's not as though we're just, you know, completely making it up as we go along. We do kind of know where we put our fingers and stuff like that.
Simon, to give our listeners a bit of a flavour of what they may be hearing next week, let's listen to a bit of the soundtrack right now.
So live, we have the musicians who played on the film as Cosy Fanatutti from Throbbing Gristle and all sorts of people. Peter Gregson playing cello. I've got a guitarist who I know. There's a little herd of musicians. Sorry, I'm kind of obsessed in this book I'm reading about buffalo hunting at the moment. So everything's sort of to do with herds of musicians. And I'm trying.
Well, no, don't worry. We can segue from the book you're reading onto my next question, because the book you're reading is by John Williams, but... I don't want to talk about that John Williams, the author, but John Williams, the film composer. Who are the, you know, obviously there's Johnny Greenwood, erstwhile of Radiohead, who's now had these fantastic collaborations with Paul Thomas Anderson on There'll Be Blood and The Master.
That was great.
Who are the sort of the new, for you, great soundtrack composers that you look at a film and go, wow, okay, they're doing something incredibly different?
I wish I knew. I don't really follow film soundtrack composers, I must confess. There's one, I really don't, there's a Canadian composer whose name I can't remember, who always does really interesting soundtracks. And there was a man recently who was very interesting on... I mean, I can't remember. James Horner, who is English, lives in America. He sounds fun because he doesn't really like doing music for films. And he loathes the sort of hypocrisy of composers who have to, you know... It's a very strange thing when you're doing music for a film, particularly obviously doing music for a Hollywood film. It seems to be quite an unpleasant job.
Well, can I ask you a bit more about that?
And I'm not really involved in that sort ofness... You know what I mean? I'm not. I appear to be rather uncommercial, which is upsetting.
You've worked with some directors who I suppose people would glibly describe as sort of auteur types. You know, thinking of people like Derek Jarman.
Yeah.
But you've also done some much more mainstream pictures.
Mike Hodges. You know, you could get more. Mm. You know, Clive Owen films.
But
whatever.
What's the difference for you when you're actually working, collaborating with these people across between, say, that slightly more not Hollywood necessarily, but just mainstream movies, and these more, again, I use the phrase sort of art house pictures. But what are the creative challenges? Is it a very different process? Do you think?
Well, I think really, I mean, what producers look for in a film composer really is somebody with a sort of orchestral knowledge, which I don't really have. I have a sound knowledge, not an orchestral knowledge. I don't sit down and I don't score everything out and write it and get it arranged. I can play something and then get it arranged. I can think of lots of things, but I'm not an orchestrator composer. And I think that's what mainly people like. They want... You know, they want composers who can say, OK, now this is the emotion of the scene, and I want you to make that, write an emotional piece of music, write a romantic piece of music about three men sitting in a recording studio. I mean, you know, what do you do? What sort of music do you do for that? And there are people who can do that, you know. I can't really. Or maybe I'm not quite sure if I try hard enough. I do, but I'm not that musical. I mean, I am musical, but I'm not musical in that sense. Does that make sense?
Well, I wonder. Do you think that's perhaps why you had, again, that word collaboration, but with some of these directors who I guess a lot of people would think have more of a kind of a singular vision, and you seem to work almost.
Well,
more
I think maybe that's
them.
It. Funny enough, I was talking about that last night. I think one of the reasons is that, for instance, if I was a filmmaker, I would want to work with people who would bring something to the table which I haven't thought of. And nowadays, a lot of directors and producers want people who can bring something to the table which everybody knows it's going to be like that and it'll do the job. I was always brought up with Derek Jarman and Mike Hodges, where, in fact, they wanted you to be adventurous. They wanted the cameraman to be adventurous, the designer. You know, you were sort of given the rope to hang yourself with and to expand and to bring something new along. You know, because film is a massive collaborative thing.
Do you think people are too conservative then now?
Absolutely, for sure. I have a problem with films where you're just doing short cues, just to underpin the story. I just don't see the point. I find it really difficult. The great thing about the film, which the Everest film, is their long cues. It's musicians playing. It seems to have a kind of life, I suppose, as opposed to rules, you know, because there are rules of film composition. You can study film composition. I think it's ridiculous. I
mean, and
you
for can something study it like this,
I'm just not that kind of a man.
And for a film like this, obviously, you know, there are no rules because, as you say, the director's dead. It's a silent film.
Sure.
They've asked you to do it. Here you are. Knock yourself out.
I had to do a test. I mean, they asked to hear 3 or 4 minutes worth after about 3 months, and I didn't really have a lot. I'd sort of broken the back of it by then, and I knew which way I wanted to go, but I certainly wasn't able to give them lots. And one of the things I did give them was breathing. And of course, the first thing they came back to me was, it sounds really good, it's very interesting, but you know, can you get rid of the breathing, please? So that whole concept of breath, of trying to get hold of climbers who climbed Everest and Chris Bonington, went completely out of the window. Ironically, at the very end, we're recording live trumpets. The guy, Andrew, who's playing the trumpet, before he puts the trumpet to his lips and starts playing properly, of course, he goes through the mouthpiece. Mm. It's exactly what I need, blah, blah. I hadn't thought about it. There it is. A year later, it's appeared, and now it's on the film. So I'm a bit of a, you know, if you think about it, I mean, this film was done in a way, if I thought about it, if it went through my head and it sort of got diced up in there, whether I used it or not didn't matter, because I've tried my hardest.
When you move on to your next projects, are there things that you've picked up and learnt, you think, from working on this film that have maybe changed the way you're going to approach future projects?
I have to say, I tend to really loathe repeating myself. So I tend to, I mean, I've played a lot on this film. Maybe next time it would be really great to not play at all, but just get everything played. So maybe I could go back to the way I worked on a film with Derek years ago of Caravaggio, where I actually played all the keyboard parts, you know, and then that was arranged for strings by an arranger, for instance. Maybe I could go back and... But I really enjoyed playing a lot on this, you know. Once I got my sounds, I was just doing a lot of looking at the film, playing long cues. But now I'm repeating myself. Have I learned anything? Turn your telephone off in the recording studio. But funnily enough, live, you see, I love things like that live when you're doing a concert and phones go off. I think it's great. I'm a great one for embracing
really?
All that.
Really? You like that?
Yes, yeah. Well, this concert, yeah, keep your phones on. It'll be quite funny. You know, you're up Everest. And ring, ring. But no, I mean, have I learned things? Yes, I've sort of learned. At the beginning of this film, I called up a friend of mine and said, can you come and listen? Because I wasn't sure whether I was going down the right track. And Gareth Jones, who's a producer, came along. He said, I can't believe it. You're writing tunes, which was all I needed to hear, really, because I appear to not really be known for writing tunes or having rhythm. But actually, they're always in there. They may be a bit slow and they may not be as obvious. But so Gareth sort of gave me the confidence to actually be more melodic than I probably have been for a long time.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there.
All right.
Sorry. Simon Fisher-Turner, thank you very much for coming in. Best of luck with the film, which is everyone here in London can see next Friday, the 18th. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're back after this.
Time for some music now on The Weekly. This is new from the US artist Glasser. This one's called Exposure.
That was Exposure by Glasser. We'll be hearing from Desmond Morris about the evolution of art, all 3 million years of it, after this.
Monocle's latest collaboration with Comme des Garçons results in a light, energizing and refreshing unisex perfume, titled and inspired by Japanese cedar Sugi. It has top notes of Mediterranean cypress and pepper from Madagascar, a hint of iris from Florence, and cedar from Virginia. With a bottle designed by Monocle's own designers, Scent 3, Sugi, is the long-awaited addition to Monocle's fragrance collection. Available in all 5 Monocle shops, Dover Street Market in London and Tokyo, and of course, online at monocle.com/shop.
Welcome back to The Monocle Weekly with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Tom Edwards. The zoologist, surrealist painter and author Desmond Morris is someone whose multifaceted career sometimes makes him hard to pigeonhole. The author of the 1960s bestseller The Naked Ape, a zoological study of contemporary human behaviour that made him a household name, now has a new book, The Artistic Ape.
And this volume looks at the evolution of art within human society over the not insignificant period of the past 3 million years. To make some sense of it all, Desmond joins us on the line now from Oxford. Desmond, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Thanks for joining us. I wanted to ask you first, it's quite intriguing. You sort of stand across several of these worlds, scientist and artist. How would you describe yourself? Does it even matter, do you think, to make a distinction between being a scientist and an artist?
Oh, they're two very different worlds. I call them the two hemispheres of my brain. You know, the human brain has one hemisphere that's devoted to analysis and calculation. The other hemisphere is more to do with imagination. And some people, you know, like accountants, spend their whole time using one half of their brain. Poets and artists use the other half of the brain. I'm lucky because I can use both halves of my brain. In fact, I have my library and my studio are next door to one another, and I call them the two hemispheres of my brain. And I, since a very, very early age, I've been active in both spheres. They are very different because when you're dealing with art, what you're doing is you're taking the ordinary and making it extraordinary. The whole essence of art, and this is the basis of my new book, Artistic Ape, is to understand art as a way in which we make life more exciting. We take a drab life and we make it colourful. That's the essence of art, and it applies to all the things we do, not just the wonderful masterpieces in museums, but the way we choose our clothes or decorate our houses or choose a motor car, anything in life. Almost everything we do has an aesthetic element in it where we're choosing something because it's more beautiful than something else or more exciting than something else. And that's the artistic process, making a drab life more colorful, more complicated, and more exaggerated. Science is the exact opposite. The scientific process is to take something extremely complicated that we don't understand and we can't figure out how it works, and to simplify it. And by experimentation and prediction and analysis, we take a complex phenomenon and make it simple so that we can understand it. And so the two processes of art and science are very different. That doesn't mean to say that if you're involved in both, that one doesn't influence the other. I mean, obviously, my knowledge of biological shapes and colors influences my painting. I started both at school. When I was at school, I got interested in painting and started to paint pictures, strange pictures, which nobody wanted and everybody hated. And I tried as a young man to become a professional artist, but nobody would buy my paintings. So it didn't stop me painting. I went on painting and still am painting today. But I had to do it as a sort of private pursuit. And in order to earn a living, I switched to my other passion, which was animals, and started to study animals and ended up talking about animals on television and had a career as a television presenter with animals back in the 50s and 60s.
Desmond, I want to ask you about one of the chapters that has really taken me in the artistic ape is all about child art. And you've got these wonderful examples of whether it's the results when six children were asked to draw a giraffe, and some are quite basic and some are quite creative. And there's one with sort of an elephant's head, which turns into a giraffe. But in particular, there's a drawing by a two-year-old girl of a human figure, which, frankly, if you hadn't annotated it to explain what was the eye, where was the nose and so on, would look like a, in a way, it's a bit of a Picasso, a sort of a mix between some of his odder stuff and the famous dove he did.
Well, it's funny you should mention Picasso, because Picasso said once, when I was a child, I could paint like an old master. Now I'm an adult, I'm doing my best to try and paint like a child. That was Picasso's whole motivation, that he wanted to get back
to... What is it you think that we learn from how a child draws and how they see the world about how that child thinks?
Well, we learn two things. One is that we learn that all human beings have an urge to be visually creative. It's something that seems to be very deep-seated in us. Every child... Anywhere in the world you go, if you give them pencil and paper or crayons and a piece of card, they will start to make images. And when the child gets to 4 or 5, 6 years old, those very young children, they all do the same kind of images. That's what's so extraordinary. It doesn't matter whether they're Japanese or Russian or American or English. They all do the same kind of images. It's usually they make a circle, and then they have arms and legs coming out of that circle, and inside it they put dots and blobs for eyes, nose, and mouth, and so on. And that strange creature which they create then grows and develops as they get older and becomes more and more related to a human figure. But it is extraordinary that if you go anywhere in the world and give a very young child, 4 or 5-year-old child, pencil and paper, they all do the same thing. It's as though inside the human child, there is this urge to portray the human figure, but in this very strange form. And what is interesting, the second point about child art, is that what's so interesting is that they are not at that stage, they don't care particularly about whether it looks exactly like the outside world. Trying to copy the outside world is something that happens with teenagers when they get older. And then they start to try and be accurate in their portrayals. But to the young child, it's much more imaginative. And the child would do all sorts of strange shapes and colors because they find them exciting. And this is what has happened, of course, to modern art. Because once photography took over the role of recording the visual world accurately, the artist was free to explore again. And that's why a lot of modern art is, in a sense, rather childlike. Not only Picasso, but Miro and Klee and a whole series of modern artists have become more childlike, but in a sophisticated way, of course. I'm not saying that their work is childish. On the contrary, what they have is sort of childlike expression of simply the joy of colors and shapes. But to that, they add their very sophisticated experience.
Desmond, it's interesting that you quote from the archaeologist Paul Barn in the book, talking about the human species. This sort of reflects what you said there about these shared ideas that children seem to have, that the human species as a whole is incapable of being artless. Do you think that is true? And do you think that tells us anything about, for instance, some of the other great apes, for example? Because there's some wonderful pieces in the book. We've got the pictures of Congo, the chimpanzee, my personal favourite. And there seems to be elements in which these apes can actually express themselves in some way using paint and paper. Do you think that apes like us perhaps are incapable of being artless? It's just that we don't quite understand how they're expressing themselves.
Well, the problem with apes is that you can't talk to them and discuss anything with them. That's one of the big snags. Because, of course, when a child starts to draw, parent looks at the child's drawing and they say, oh, that's nice, what's that? And they say, oh, that's mummy, or that's dad. They start to use words to identify the shapes that they're making, and then that influences the future shapes. With the chimpanzee, it remains purely abstract. But what was so fascinating to me when I made my studies back in the 1950s with chimpanzees was that they struggle to compose the abstract shapes. The chimpanzee I was working with, called Congo, he definitely tried to put every line on the paper where he wanted it. It was visually controlled. It wasn't random scribbling. And what happened was that if I would put, say, a square on the right-hand side of the page, he would balance it with lines on the left side and vice versa. So he understood left-right balance. He understood basic composition, even though he was only capable of making little abstract patterns. And this was something that surprised me, I must confess. I didn't think a chimpanzee brain would be capable of this, but he was passionate about it. If I tried to stop him in the middle of a drawing, he'd have a temper tantrum. I mean, it was extraordinary that he knew when he'd finished his picture and he wouldn't go on, but if you try to stop him in the middle of doing a drawing, he would be furious. And he was not getting any reward for this. I wasn't giving him reward for his work. He found a passion for this, and I worked with him. He made about 400 pictures altogether. Incidentally, those pictures were immediately understood by people like Picasso. In fact, Picasso had one of Congo's paintings. And when a reporter asked Picasso what he thought of the chimpanzee painting, Picasso's response was typically bizarre. He bit the reporter, which I thought was a lovely way of saying the chimpanzee and I have something in common. But only Picasso would respond that way, I suppose. But the point is that whether it's an ape or whether it's a human being, there does seem to be this urge to be visually creative. And with human beings, I've traveled now to over 100 countries. It's 107 countries I've visited now because I've been traveling to study art all over the world. And wherever I've been, I haven't yet found a culture that is artless. It seems even in the most primitive world, I went to part of Africa where the temperature was about 130. The Turkana people living in this area had nothing. They just had a little tiny hut made of bits of wood, a few goats, and they were right on the edge of survival. And yet, when you looked at the loincloth, which is all that the females were wearing, they were covered in little beads that they'd managed to get from somewhere or other, done in little designs and decorations. And when you looked at the men, who've got, as I say, absolutely nothing in the way of possessions, but they had found some white feathers and stuck them in their hair. And I thought, how extraordinary that these people living on the edge of survival still have the urge to just make their world a little bit more colorful, a little bit more decorated than it would have to be for purely survival purposes. And that's the point. We go beyond survival. Our brains are not prepared to rest. When we've got beyond survival, we've got our food, we've got our drink, we've got our shelter, the basic facts are taken care of. And now, what do? We don't lie around and sleep like a lion. A lion sleeps for twice as long as we do. We sleep for about 8 hours a day and lions sleep for 16 hours. We're not like lions. Our brains won't stop becoming active. We have busy brains. And if we have any spare time or spare energy, we do something with it. We can't help it. The whole business of the artistic ape, it all started out in the days when we became hunters and we had great feasts. And at those feasts, we started to dance and to sing and to decorate our faces and to make the occasion more celebratory, more extraordinary. And that was where it all began, and then from there it developed, of course, until today we have great masterpieces.
Desmond, let's bring it sort of full circle. You begin the book in your introduction, you talk about definitions you have of art and science and of religion. So if we do go full circle, remind us what those definitions are, because it's quite interesting, isn't it? I think it's a very helpful sort of take on how to define those three things. It's not always easy, but you volunteer your best effort in your introduction to the book.
It just took me about a month to get those definitions, to get them exactly right. I'll read them to you. Art is making the extraordinary out of the ordinary to entertain the brain. Science is making the simple out of the complicated to understand our existence. And religion is making the believable out of the unbelievable to reduce the fear of dying. Because, of course, it was when we started to talk, and we could talk not only in the present tense, because the other animals only communicate in the present tense. If an animal roars or screams, it's telling you about its mood at that moment. But when we started to talk, we invented the past tense and the future tense, and that was our undoing in a way. It was, of course, tremendously important, because when we had the past tense, we could think about history, and when we had the future tense, we could think about the future. But then we started to think about the future, thought, hang on, we're going to die one day. And this, of course, a dog never knows it's going to die. If you have a pet cat or a pet dog, they have this marvelous thing. They never realize they're going to die, and they can't contemplate death. Once we started to contemplate the fact we're going to die, this was very worrying, and we had to defend ourselves against that by conceiving of an afterlife, which we don't know whether it exists or not, but we decided that we would introduce this idea of an afterlife. It made the whole business of dying less frightening.
On that note, Desmond, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Desmond Morris, thank you very much for joining us on the Monocle Weekly.
It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Desmond Morris, the book is The Artistic Ape. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. We're back after this.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got The Curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
Victorian Britain was many things: poverty-stricken, socially conservative, and pretty filthy, to name just three. But it was also the era when the Industrial Revolution made the UK the centre of the Western world and ushered in some of the brightest minds, from engineers to social planners, that the world has ever known.
A new history of the era, High Minds, the Victorians and the Birth of Modern Britain, tells the story of the 19th century, focusing on the work of intellectuals and politicians, ranging from William Gladstone to Thomas Carlyle.
Simon Heffer, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Let's start with the book in front of me here, High Minds, the Victorians and the Birth of Modern Britain. Why did you feel the need for another book on the Victorians? It seems like, you know, if I was to walk down the road to Daunce, there'll be an entire sort of stack of them.
Do you know, I thought that when my agent, Georgina Capel, suggested I wrote the book 3 years ago. I said to her, come on, darling, everyone's done the Victorians. And she said, well, no, actually everyone hasn't. Ian Wilson wrote a very good book on the Victorians, which was published in 2001, which is 12 years ago. And as Andrew would be the first to admit, it's a book largely compiled from secondary sources. It's a tour d'horizon of the Victorians. And I knew from having written a book nearly 20 years ago on Thomas Carlyle and having been into his archive at the National Library of Scotland and having looked at the archives of some of his contemporaries like Ruskin and John Stuart Mill and Charles Kingsley and Charles Dickens, that there was an awful lot out there buried in archives that was of great interest and that illuminated various aspects of Victorian Britain, and which I thought deserved an airing. So I then managed to get a sabbatical and spent 8 or 9 months in libraries, mainly the British Library, but also other institutions that had the archives of these people. And Florence Nightingale's papers are in, I think, 120 volumes in the British Library. Gladstone's papers, I think, are in about 130 volumes. And however exhaustive some of their biographers have been, there's still stuff in there which shows aspects of their character, like Florence Nightingale's support for the women's suffrage movement in the 1860s, which I thought deserved a wider audience. Also, the book is not a linear history, although it goes roughly from 1840 to 1880. I've tried to choose great themes of the period to show how the country progressed. What I didn't realise until I started to examine the 1840s was just how medieval a country Britain was in the 1840s. It wasn't just that women had no rights and children had no rights. Most men had no rights either. And, you know, we were a very backward feudal country. And yet by 1880, we're a country where women do have certain rights, they don't have the vote, where children are protected by the factory acts and where the state provides an education for them in many cases, and where almost all men have got the vote. So I wanted to write a book saying, well, how did this happen? How was this transformation made from this feudal, almost despotism, into a country that had the makings of a democracy?
You're in a way making a fairly sort of liberal argument, really, there, aren't you? You're highlighting people like Gladstone and Florence Nightingale. You're talking about, you know, the suffragette movement and the advances of the state providing things for people. And yet, you know, you're Simon Heffer of The Telegraph and The Spectator and The Daily Mail.
Well, hang on a minute. I don't actually talk about the state providing. The book is about the state enabling. And, well, Gladstone is my hero. I think Gladstone is probably the greatest prime minister this country has ever had in war or peace. And one reason why I admired the late Margaret Thatcher so much was that she, to me, was a Gladstonian liberal. She wasn't a conservative. There was very little conjunction between Margaret Thatcher and the conservatives of the 1950s and 60s, into whose party she came as a young MP. But Gladstone had the view that the state should be an enabling state. It should pass laws that made philanthropy more easy, that made it easy for local corporations using locally raised money to improve things, like to improve sanitation and to improve roads and to provide schools and stuff like that. And Gladstone was very much in favour of a meritocracy. It was Gladstone who, in the 1850s, as Chancellor of the Exchequer, reformed the civil service. You had to buy your way into the civil service. You had to know people who were in the civil service until 1850 to get a job there. After that, you could take an exam. So any bright young person, mainly, of course, men in those days, because they were the more educated sex, could get a job in the civil service if he could pass the exam. He also, when he was prime minister, abolished the purchase of commissions in the army. He wanted the army to be regulated according to merit and not according to whether you had a very rich daddy who could afford to buy you a commission.
So I wonder then, you talk about that period of change in around about half a century. It is truly remarkable. There are a great deal of progress. There are a lot of progressive characters. What's the sort of perfect storm that enables that to happen? Is it because there are people? We talk about Gladstone, for example. Do you need those singular individuals? Or do you think there sometimes can, if, as you look through British society over 200-300 years, everything falls into place to enable that kind of progressive change to happen?
There are a number of factors. It was the marriage of technological advance, of course. We'd had the Industrial Revolution 2 generations earlier before my book starts. But you've got industrialists who are making a great deal of money and who then also have a Christian desire to help people and to provide better for their workers. We have this idea of the nasty utilitarian Victorian mill owner like Mr. Gradgrind and Mr. Bounderby in Dickens's Hard Times. But actually many of them were people who realised, like the great Titus Salt of the wool merchant of Bradford, that the better they treated their employees, the better their employees would work for them and the more productive they would be and the more money they'd make for them. This was a lesson they learned from Robert Owen at Lanark at the turn of the 18th and 19th century. But you did have a lot of people who owned mills and indeed coal mines, like the Fitzwilliam family in South Yorkshire, who built really quite lovely villages and schools and hospitals and libraries for their miners and their families.
Can we move on to another book you've written, which was Your Style Guide? Now, I was going to try and read out one of your missives when you were at The Telegraph. You sent these quite regular emails
to
members of staff. Were you okay with them becoming public? Because they were supposedly private, weren't they?
They were supposed to be private, but I never named anybody.
No, that's true.
And that was a deliberate policy on my part, because I didn't want people to feel humiliated. But I did take the view that we were paying our journalists quite well and they were supposed to be professional writers. And some of them seemed to have great difficulty in writing English properly. One or two of my colleagues seemed to write it as almost as a second language when they weren't actually from another culture. So I did find that alarming.
Where do you think the standards are now? If you go back into the newsroom and there's the subs at work, do you think things have moved on? Have there been any retrograde steps since your days of compiling those messages?
The problem that we all have in journalism in recruiting people is we are recruiting people who, in many cases, have been victims of the state education system. And not just victims of the British state education system, but also I've recruited people from very good private schools, or people have come to me wanting jobs from very good private schools, who are semi-literate. I ran the Telegraph Graduate Trainee Scheme, and 3 years ago it would have been a young man who had graduated from Cambridge with a double first in English, so he was not stupid. I only have a second in English, so I looked up to him enormously. He came to me and we took a spelling test. They took a spelling test. It was 45 of the hardest words to spell in English. And he only got 18.
What sort of words are these?
Oh, words like mantelpiece.
Is mantelpiece difficult because some people go mantel rather than mantle?
Well, they spell it M-A-N-T-L-E rather than M-A-N-T-E-L. So most people got between 35 and 45. I mean, I wouldn't give someone a job on a newspaper for obvious reasons if they can't spell. But even if you're trying to get a job in a bank, if you then start to write to the bank's customers and you write your letters illiterately, people will say, well, hang on, I thought this bank was a serious bank. I'll go and bank with one that is.
There we are. That's that, Tom. We got to the end.
It was a rollercoaster ride, Steve, but I enjoyed every minute of it.
We had a lot of talkers today, didn't we?
There was some quite high-end chat on today's show.
The two Simons.
I like it. Maybe we should do some kind of name-themed shows more often.
What, Simon, Simon and Simon?
Yeah.
Yeah, we could, actually.
And the show could be called simply Simon Says.
Or it could just be simply Simon.
I like it.
Okay. Well, there we are. That's another idea.
Let's roll this out for next week.
Next week's weekly will be brought to you by Simon and Simon. I thought, yes, they were talkers. Desmond Morris.
Fascinating. Big fan
of
his.
Talker.
Anything to do with, a monkey doing a picture or eating a lunch in a fancy restaurant, I'm all over that.
That's your level, really, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I feel that Danny Giacopelli didn't quite reach your level on next week's news. I think it was a good try for a beginner.
Well, that's tied in quite nicely with Desmond Morris, I thought. I now will consider Danny Giacopelli to be the Monocle News Monkey.
I've seen his art as well. And there's no way I'm taking Danny Giacopelli to dinner.
No. Good strategy all round.
On that note, that is pretty much it for this edition 223 of the Monocle Weekly. Thank you very much to our producer, Tom Hall. We'll be here again next week, possibly with Andrew and indeed Robert Pound. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Steve Bloomfield.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Goodbye.